Good morning, everyone. It's Sunday, March 10th. I'm John Weigel, and this is the weekend edition of the Hustle Daily Show. Today, I'll be chatting with Taylor Lorenz about her book, Extremely Online, The Influencer Economy, AI's Integration into Social Media, TikTok Shop, and much more. So let's get into it. All right, everybody. We got a great guest on the pod today. She's the author of the book Extremely Online, which I have here. And she's a culture and tech reporter at The Washington Post. And she's a meme aficionado. It's Taylor Lorenz. Welcome, Taylor. How you doing?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. It's great to finally meet you face to face. I'm really excited to talk about everything that we got on the docket today. First thing I really wanted to dig into a bit is your book, which I read through. Loved it. It really paints the history of influencers very well from kind of like the MySpace era to now. I would just love to know what compelled you to kind of get into writing a book and putting all your thoughts on paper.
Yeah, well, it was the pandemic in 2020. Obviously, we're still in a pandemic, but like height of, you know, sort of right. lockdown era 2020. And I just sort of saw a lot of revisionism happening. Like everyone got really online during that period, including a lot of Silicon Valley venture capitalists who had kind of ignored the creator industry for years. And I just saw more and more people talking about it and getting interested in sort of online culture. I think also that's when TikTok started to take off and like Gen Z started to like have more of a footprint on the internet. And I guess I got like triggered into writing it because a lot of people were putting out a lot of like wrong information. And I was like, you know, I've covered this beat for almost 15 years. And I'm going to write sort of the history of the content creator industry. I think there's a lot of amazing nonfiction tech books that cover the history of social media from the perspective of certain companies. So like The Social Network, Sarah Friar's great book, No Filter, about Instagram, Mark Bergen's Like, Comment, Subscribe about YouTube. But I wanted to sort of like zoom out and not and cover it from the content creator side and not a specific platform. So sort of talk about the rise of all these platforms from Vine to MySpace to YouTube to YouNow and TikTok and everything and talk about how this industry formed.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating because so much literature and movies and media has kind of just been on who made these platforms and who created these networks, but not a lot has been done on the creators on these platforms and kind of the journey that becoming a recognizable person on the internet took and kind of the form of that and becoming, you know, financially viable for yourself by just internet means. So I thought that was like a really awesome journey through the book. And I wanted to know something a bit after you finished writing it, because it did come out around October. And I want to know any changes on the internet that you've seen since this book came out that you wish were integrated into it or you wish you could go back and like put that in now.
Yeah. Well, the book kind of ends around when the pandemic happens, because at that point, everyone becomes sort of like super extremely online. So it's really about the first 20 years of the social internet, sort of from the turn of the millennium 2000 to 2020, when sort of like everything starts to take off. I think since 2021, 2022, there's been another shift where we're really seeing the next wave of social media. I think with Twitter kind of collapsing and changing so much, TikTok taking off, all these other platforms, and then also the rise of AI and platforms like Discord that are not necessarily social platforms, but they're more like chat apps and live streaming. Like it's just changed a lot. So there was still a lot that I wish I could have put in.
You did mention something about AI. That's kind of been a fascinating beat to cover recently with all these changes happening very rapidly, too fast for the government, kind of too fast for any regulatory force to kind of upend them. But in terms of AI on social media, the integration of that is kind of a big subject lately. So there is actually an AI fitness model named Aitana Lopez, who was kind of created by a Spanish agency over in Barcelona. She's not real. She's kind of an AI generated model. And she is getting followers, getting brand deals. Do you think that creators have anything to worry about in the future in terms of this?
Yeah, this is not a thing. This is not what the future of influencers or the internet or AI girls is going to look like. You sort of see these attempts at this. And I love Trevor, by the way, that made Lil Michaela, but like Lil Michaela is the same thing. Like, it's like nobody wants to see like images of hot girls doing that. I think the AI stuff is useful for OnlyFans content creators because a lot of them use AI generated girls to kind of bait people into subscribing to OnlyFans. That's a whole sort of growth model there. This kind of stuff is just boring. Like, this person is not doing video content at all. This looks like just a Spanish like rehash of Lil Michaela, to be honest. And look at the engagement. It's not very good. No hate, but
So influencers have nothing to worry about, is what you're saying.
AI lowers the barrier to content creation. That allows for an entire new genre of influencers, mostly faceless influencer accounts, right? Because you can just generate this AI-generated content
right.
that's interest-based on a massive scale. And so you can run these successful accounts. I think people that are trying to make things like this Ayana or whatever, Lopez girl, it's like they're taking this like 2015 concept of what they think an influencer is and then trying to make that happen on a video-dominated internet.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how it works. But there's definitely a rise in AI influencer accounts. They're just not like that.
Yeah, I kind of like what you brought up about the 2015 kind of influencer account, the one that posts about like doing fitness and avocado toast and kind of at their favorite cafe with latte art. I think that's another big point about your book that I wanted to talk about in that transformation from that, from the 2014, 2015 big time Instagram influencer to now where it's a little more real. What do you kind of attribute to that change of people becoming a little more real in front of the camera and on social media?
I have a YouTube video coming out about this soon that I've been working on for like months. I need to publish it. But I think a huge shift was this shift from photos to videos, because you saw the rise of all of these very lifestyle driven content creators where their whole thing is like aspirational beauty. And there's a lot of aspirational video content as well, but I think video content is inherently kind of different. Mm-hmm. You have to be more relatable. You saw this shift a little bit happen with Instagram stories. When Instagram stories first happened, like content creators were really stressed out because they were like, oh, now I have to be really candid when my whole brand is very curated. Then of course, people started to just really curate their Instagram stories.
Mm-hmm.
I think videos can force you to be more authentic. You can obviously still create really aspirational content on video as well. It's just harder. The bar for content has been raised, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And the amount of content you probably have to make has also raised as well.
Yes, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. And the quality has to be much better too. You can't put out like a garbage looking video. It has to look good.
Right, right. And kind of stepping out of the AI bubble a bit more, something else I wanted to bring up is a lot about TikTok Shop, because of course you spend a lot of time on TikTok. I do too. Lately, within the past maybe few months or year, I've been seeing just a ton of TikTok Shop ads from just creators, you know, being able to sell these products and gain some capital from it. What's your take on the amount of that content available right now? Do you see it as a very, very good thing and an empowering thing for creators? Or do you think it's kind of muddying the platform a little bit?
No, it's the bane of my existence. I feel like everyone hates it. It reminds me of in 2018, Instagram went through the same pivot where they pivoted really hard to shopping. That was their number one goal that year. And now I think, look, there's an e-commerce layer to Instagram that most people don't think about very much. I think TikTok will eventually become the same. I think TikTok is especially leaning really hard into shop right now because of the threat of regulation and not knowing where the sort of political system will go in the US. Obviously, there's been efforts to ban TikTok. I think if people are using TikTok more to shop for ring lights rather than sort of speak about Palestine, that's better for the company. So I think it makes them less controversial. So, you know, I understand why the company is doing that, but I think it's a really bad user experience. Sure, some creators are making some money, but at what cost? It's right. Like the worst experience ever. I hate TikTok Shop.
Right. There's one of these videos that's been going around. I don't know how I've seen it like 5 times now. The same video. It's a guy at like some Roman ruins or something. And he's like, yo, these pants are fire. And there's no actual picture of the pants in the entire video.
No way.
And it went viral so many times. It
That's
is
so funny.
Ridiculous what's happening here. But you did mention TikTok's kind of in some hot water now in the world. And I think even like the EU and New York City are investigating platforms like TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, and YouTube for allegedly giving negative mental health effects to youth. What do you make of that scenario as well?
I think it is the dumbest thing alive. I think that it's so disingenuous for these governments, especially the US government with the Kids Online Safety Act, which I think is abhorrent legislation. It's ostensibly aimed at protecting kids. It does not do that, according to any major LGBTQ rights group or group that represents marginalized kids. You know, to say that you're acting in the interest of kids' mental health and to not do anything else to alleviate kids' mental health and then try to ban them from the internet until they turn 18 is just deranged. And by the way, we've seen major Pew studies, for instance, the biggest study ever of Facebook and social media use. I think it took over 1 million people from 72 countries over 12 years or something insane. It was actually an Oxford study that came out that found no correlation between negative mental health and social media use. In fact, there's a much stronger correlation between people's immediate circumstances. What's their job situation like? What's their financial situation like? What's their immediate family and health situation like? All of those things affect your mental health far more significantly than social media. And regulators don't care about doing any of that. They don't care about stopping the pandemic so that people stop getting sick so often. They don't care about banning guns or something in school, or at least restricting guns in school so that there's less school shootings. And also just like minimum wage has not been raised in years. You know, people are working longer hours than ever. And school kids, I mean, what kids have to go through these days with school is absolutely insane. Mm-hmm.
So would you say that, I guess, social media is a bit of a scapegoat nowadays in these kind of situations where there could be other things that regulators and lawmakers could be focusing on, but instead they're focusing on this scapegoat of, you know, TikTok in school is making things bad?
Exactly. 100%. Mm-hmm. I think it's a huge scapegoat. I think TikTok and the internet is sort of like a mirror, and it will reflect back your life conditions. And sometimes it provides amazing solidarity and communication and connection. And sometimes it's a source of sadness and grief and frustration, just the way that the real world is. But to sort of single out social media and call it this unique harm, when in fact, social media is repeatedly used as a tool to speak truth to power, mm-hmm. actually. I mean, that's what these people are mad about. As Lindsey Graham said in the COSA, the Kids Online Safety Act hearing, he wants to ban TikTok because he thinks TikTok is, quote, destroying Israel. And Marsha Blackburn, the co-sponsor of the Kids Online Safety Act, said that the reason she's backing this legislation is because she thinks that social media is indoctrinating children into the LGBTQ lifestyle. And that's why she wants to keep kids off of it, because she thinks it's turning them gay. So I think it's all very ridiculous.
Well, you actually had quite a conversation about that a little bit ago with Kaya Raichik from Libs of TikTok. And I saw that conversation. It was about 53 minutes. And the amount of circles that were went in was kind of insane on those very subjects. Can you talk to me a little bit about that time you had with her?
Yeah. So Kaya Raichik is a far right content creator. Most people know her as Libs of TikTok on Twitter. She got really famous a couple of years ago. She was boosted by Joe Rogan, Tucker Carlson, Glenn Greenwald, just a bunch of like brain poisoned internet people for sharing a lot of anti-trans hate. She spread a lot of conspiracy theories, such as the fact that kids were being forced to use litter boxes because they identify as cats. That ended up not being true at all. She's now appointed to the State Education Committee in Oklahoma, where she oversees what books are in public schools there, despite the fact that she does not live in Oklahoma and has only visited the state once. So I was writing a story about that this week, connected to the transgender teenager's death, mm-hmm. Nex, who was a non-binary child that was killed, and it's a potential hate crime. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I met up with her and did an interview, and she kind of just couldn't defend a single one of her ideological beliefs. I was asking her about, you know, why she thinks trans people should be eradicated, and she just couldn't articulate it.
Yeah. And that's something that I wanted to harp on for a second, because I feel like it seems, you know, the internet has gotten increasingly polarized over time, where you have these accounts kind of like Libs of TikTok coming up that are just very, very on one side. And then you obviously have the other side of the coin with these platforms and accounts that are completely just steadfast on the other side. Is there anything that we can do about this? I guess is my question to you, because it seems like the internet a lot of the time is fed off of reactions and fed off of negativity or fed off of agreeing with somebody and that relatability. Is there any action that we as users or creators can even take to kind of merge this gap a little more?
I mean, I think we need to stop feeding reactionary trolls. And I don't mean feeding by not engaging with them, but really be explicit on calling these people out on their BS. Like, the reason that these people like Chaya are able to amass the power that they have is because they're sort of able to operate behind a screen and not really be confronted with people that might disagree with their views or that might be able to dismantle their alleged sort of ideology. And I think you see this time and time again. And especially on the far right, they do not want to engage with more progressive news media or whatever. Mm. And I think that's a shame. And by the way, I think it's true on the left too, but I do think that the left engages more with the right than the right engages with the left, other than the right is like just sort of dunking on people all the time or being like, oh, you know, these triggered gay people or something, but they'll never actually sit down and do an interview. And so I was quite shocked that she agreed to it. Honestly, I couldn't believe it, because I was like, wow, great. And I wanted to make sure that I published the footage, because I've done other contentious interviews and the people look bad, and so they never publish the footage.
Yeah, I was quite shocked that she agreed to it too. And as I saw, I think online, maybe from one of your account posts actually, that was the interview originally supposed to be 5 minutes?
Yes, it was. Yes.
Wow.
So she kept talking.
Well, I guess that worked out. And kind of on that subject, a little bit more about these two sides of media and kind of these polarizing views. One of the big notes in your book, or maybe even the last defining note, is that we are the media now, is that people can create media. People can put their thoughts out there and put their opinions out there and gain a following, or put information out there and gain a following. Has that change brought to light issues that aren't really covered by mainstream media usually? Because obviously we get fed similar things every day from similar sources, and the fact that anybody could be a corroborator for media, has that just completely changed the game?
I think it's totally changed the game. I think it's an amazing development in so many ways. It's also a very harmful development.
Yeah.
I think it's read to the rise of like conspiracy theories like QAnon and other things. Like, there is this alternative far right media ecosystem that promotes tons of disinformation, saying that like Trump won the election and just things that are just objectively false. But I think that it's also really powerful to give people a voice. I mean, look at sort of the activism that's been going on right now with stuff going on in Palestine, for instance. The mainstream media is just not covering the war in the way that a lot of sort of Americans feel it should be. And I think a lot of people are able to use their voice, and Palestinian journalists are able to use their voice through the internet to kind of report on these atrocities. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very powerful and important.
It seems like there's always people out there doing it for the good of everything and finding these truths and being able to broadcast these truths. But there's also a side of it that's kind of negative and amassing just groups of people that wouldn't otherwise have any way of getting together or knowing their views are similar. So that's fascinating to me. And hearing one of your stories that you did recently in the Washington Post, mm-hmm. nearly 30% of kids ages 8 to 12 listed YouTuber as their top career choice. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Where do you see this netting out? Because there are already so many creators and already so many people that speak their minds and are sources for information. Do you think that there's room for many more generations of creators, or do you think it's kind of capped at this point and reaching a limit?
Oh, it's definitely not capped. Oh, no, because everybody gets tired of everything after like a month or a year or whatever. No, I mean, also you need young people speaking to their own generation, right? You need young people talking about information and events through the lens of media that resonates with them. So I'm a huge supporter of sort of like young people and independent media and all of that, even if they don't always get it 100% right. I also think, you know, parents always freak out about these stats when they worry about it. Most of those kids, despite the fact that they say that, they will not, right? Like, I mean, I remember growing up, I'm a millennial, so I was a child in the 90s, but like, you know, people would be like, I want to be a famous basketball player or something. It's like, you're probably not going to be that. But at least with being a content creator, the kid's going to learn valuable skills. You learn marketing, you learn script writing, you learn video editing, you learn often how to edit graphics, mm-hmm. learn communication skills. Like, there's valuable transferable skills that you can learn even if you pursue a career as a content creator and flop. And so I don't think it's the worst thing in the world for your kid to kind of chase after, as long as they don't just start getting fully engagement pilled where they're just doing extreme stunts to try to like get views.
Yeah.
I think it's probably harmless.
No 2014 Logan Paul content
no,
we're looking for.
We do not
no,
need
none of
that.
No way. Hard pass.
Yeah.
And something I wanted to chat about on that is, in reporting on these things and in writing this book and in doing these things and creating your own content, you've also kind of become a content creator slash public figure yourself. What is your experience in that? Because as I imagine, as I'm sure, that you receive quite a lot of indoctrination and hate and all these things, but also at the same time, a lot of positives. What has your experience been kind of being in the public eye and having that eye on you?
Well, I started as a content creator, so I never went to journalism school.
Right.
I never mm-hmm. aspired to work in journalism. I was a blogger back when that was the primary sort of thing. And then I got a following on Instagram. I ran a bunch of popular accounts on different platforms and stuff. And I was an internet personality. I think it's so funny because in the early 2010s, the word influencer didn't exist yet. And so there's some article that called me like I can't remember what it was, social media something, but basically like a social media personality. Mm-hmm. So I have been subject to the dynamics of the internet for a long time, even before I got into journalism. I think going into journalism, it's really actually changed my view of the media more than the internet. Like, I'm used to dealing with the mechanics of the internet or having fandoms come after me or getting into drama, like whatever. I've done that so many times over, but I used to have a real kind of disrespect for the mainstream media, and I used to talk very critically about it. I still talk critically about it in a lot of ways, but I do think journalism is important, and I do think it's important to preserve these journalistic institutions because they are the only ones that have the resources to do real hardcore reporting. Like, content creators, that model is not going to get the level of reporting that we need. And I made a video about this recently on YouTube and TikTok, but, you know, areas without journalists like really suffer. You're likely to pay higher taxes. You're likely to have more corruption. Like, it's bad. And I know everyone hates on journalists, but like, they really do generally do a public service. And so I think my views on journalism have become like, now that I'm in the industry, I'm like, okay, wait, I think this is important.
Like, wait, hold up. This actually might be a big deal.
I don't know if my work is, but certainly some people. I mean, certainly some of my colleagues do amazing work. Mm-hmm. And it makes me sad. It makes me sad to see the death of the legacy media in some ways. In some ways, they deserve it.
Yeah, I often flip-flop on that too, actually, having worked in a lot of media companies in my day. Yeah, I tend to feel that way as well. We need them, but I'm kind of mad at them.
Yeah.
But they're nice to have sometimes.
We need something. Yeah, I totally get it. You know, I don't know.
Something needs to be there.
If it needs to be the New York Times, but it should be something. I can say that because I work there. No hate.
And how has that experience been for you in diving deeper into these stories, doing some investigative journalism, kind of getting your hands dirty with this information?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I love doing all sorts of stories and I like telling stories in different formats. So I think it's been really fun. I love my editor right now and I couldn't do my job without my editor, and he's retiring soon. So I'm in the grieving process right now, but you know, I think it's just such a rare gift to be able to learn from somebody that's been in the business for so long and to be able to do this type of reporting that is increasingly rare and difficult to find a job doing. So I'm really lucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And something I wanted to ask a little lighter. Can you tell me the best TikTok hole you fell into recently? Like, what has just kind of like encompassed your life in the past week?
Okay, I don't know about the past week. There's drama in the fountain pen community.
I heard about this.
Yeah, over this purple ink. This guy made this like tea video about it, and then I went down a complete hole. And then now I'm like learning about the undertones of fountain pen ink. There was this purple that was released in 2016 as a limited edition color, and they re-released it. And they said it was the same, but it actually wasn't the same. And it's caused a lot of controversy. So that's after Who the F*** Did I Marry ended. Now I'm onto the fountain pen.
Wow. That really is the beauty of TikTok.
Yeah.
Completely immersed in something you knew nothing about 24 hours ago.
And I have strong opinions on it now. I'm like, what the hell?
Yes, you do. Last few things that I wanted to ask you about. We talked about TikTok Shop. We talked about a little bit of commercialism kind of bleeding into social media now and then. I was going to ask you what you think about brands branching into TikTok, branching into Instagram and kind of all these social platforms, and if it can be done very well. Because, you know, I know all these brands are looking for social media managers. All these brands out there are looking to hire people to create just bounds and bounds and bounds of TikTok content for them. Can it be done right? Can it be done well to the point where brands should incorporate more TikTok?
I mean, I think it's helpful for brands to be on there. I think they can insert themselves into moments. You saw like the Stanley, you know, that girl's car got exploded or something and the Stanley made it. And so Stanley bought her a new car. Or like, again, the Who the F*** Did I Marry series. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it was the series that went really viral. You had like Hilton Hotels and Delta Airlines, like, hey, you know, like they're trying to sort of like leverage these viral moments. I don't know about brands creating content day to day on TikTok necessarily. Some of them are good. Some of them are like less good. Mm-hmm. No one really wants to follow a brand. So I think you have to be kind of thoughtful in how you engage on those platforms.
Right.
I think sometimes just paid media is best too. Like you can run TikTok ads and you don't necessarily have to create organic content, which can be a really high lift for a lot of brands to be creating organic content every day when they don't have much to say.
Right. Exactly. And that's the tough part of it. I feel like finding something to hang your hat on every day and finding something to do every day. Because I believe you did mention in your book that, I forget, I think it was DKNY.
Yeah.
They had kind of a influencer personality, kind of upping their brand for a while. And I mean, it's pretty much all over today. Like you see, like the Wendy's Twitter account goes insane every day.
Oh, I mean, the thing is, as I write in the book, DKNY invented that. Prior to DKNY PR Girl, which was this Twitter account that was a personified kind of influencer that was like living the DKNY life, it was run by their SVP of marketing at the time. Brands did not have that personified social media, basically.
Right.
And so that was sort of the beginning of all of that. And then Red Bull sort of started to lean harder into content early as well. Red Bull had less of the personality, but they were always very like media oriented, like creating media around their brand. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's so competitive now. I think, by the way, no hate to Wendy's, but like the Twitter, what a worthless, how are you paying someone in 2024 to like sit on Twitter all day and post stuff? Like, I don't think that moves the needle. It feels very 2016 to me because I think the novelty is lost. Mm-hmm. It's not funny to see a brand post a snarky tweet in 2024. It's just like, please give us healthcare. We don't need this. This is not helping anyone. Yeah. It's stupid. I don't know. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be on social media. I just think it's more about sort of like engaging in a smart way instead of like having some 24-year-old sit there and just post all day.
Tweet every day. Yeah, exactly. I totally get it. Well, Taylor, I wanted to thank you so much for joining me. And I just one last thing was if you have anything coming up that you'd like to talk about.
Oh my gosh, just buy my book if you haven't read it yet. It's called Extremely Online, The Untold Story of Fame, Influence, and Power on the Internet. Mm-hmm. Anyone mm-hmm. that cares about the internet, I feel like it's a lot of like nostalgia for people that are like millennials or a little bit younger because we all lived through this time. So
definitely,
it's a little trip down memory lane.
I thought a lot about that when I was reading it, is that all these things were happening. I distinctly remember them happening, but I just have no idea how they happened. And it was a great descriptor of how they all happened.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much, Taylor. Really appreciate you being here.
Of course.
Thank you. And that's all we got today. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. You can watch the video interview in full over on the Hustle YouTube channel. We're a proud part of the HubSpot Podcast Network. Our editor today is Robert Hartwig, and our executive producer is Darren Clark. We've got a lot more tech and business coverage in our newsletter. If you're not subscribed, go get yourself signed up at thehustle.co/email, and we'll see you Monday.